how are people going to trust us if they see these guys getting hunted down by the Taliban or ISIS because they supported, you know, the Americans? It impacts our narratives that we promote throughout the Middle East. It impacts our veterans, you know, you and me who know these guys who have been hunted down and killed. It's a lot of veterans I talk to, they feel impotent in their ability to live up to that ethos of leave no one behind when they're leaving their most trusted Iraqi or Afghan counterpart behind. And they feel embarrassed by our country's lack of will to actually do something about it.
Welcome to Truth About War, a podcast of the Veterans Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Todd DePastino, Executive Director of the Veterans Breakfast Club. We're a nonprofit in Pittsburgh, PA that harnesses the power of storytelling to connect, heal, educate, and inspire. We hold live storytelling events, both virtually and face-to-face, and they're all open to the public. Veterans come and share their stories. You never quite know what you're going to hear. Since September 11, 2001, we've fought two drawn-out wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we sometimes refer to the people who live in these places as Iraqis and Afghans. But they're really not, because neither Iraq nor Afghanistan is truly a nation with populations unified around a common culture and identity. In Afghanistan, there are no Afghans. Instead, there are Pashtun, Tajik, Hazara, Uzbek, and several other ethnic identities that coincide with smaller but no less important tribal identities. In Iraq, it's much the same. It's a place divided between the majority Shia and the minority Sunni populations. And these groups commingle in large cities like Baghdad. Then there are the tribes, and within the tribes, clans, and within the clans, subclans. And all of these command stronger loyalties than does the nation of Iraq. This was one of the big challenges of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, navigating foreign lands crisscrossed by social fissures and fault lines that are largely undetectable to American eyes. The solution was to hire interpreters. These were local people who could translate not only the languages, but also the culture. They told American troops about the neighborhoods and villages they were entering. They alerted them to danger and even fought alongside of American forces when the bullets started flying. It was risky work, not only for interpreters, but their families. Insurgent extremists labeled interpreters who worked with U.S. forces as traitors and targeted them for torture and assassination. When we pulled out of Iraq and Afghanistan, we left a lot of these interpreters behind to the fate of ISIS and the Taliban. Our guest today is Steve Miska, a retired Army colonel who worked hard to bring these foreign brothers in arms to safety in the United States. Steve first got involved with this work while serving as an infantry officer in Iraq in 2007. He established what he calls an underground railroad to get at-risk interpreters and their families out of the country. Journalist George Packer wrote about Steve's efforts in The New Yorker, saying that Colonel Steve Miska was one soldier who had made it his last mission not to leave his Iraqi friends behind. In 2008, Congress took notice and began authorizing special immigrant visas for interpreters. Under that program, tens of thousands of Iraqi and Afghan nationals who fought along side by side with American forces on the battlefield have been safely relocated to the United States. But now that pipeline is virtually shut down. The Trump administration fears these interpreters might be security risks. Because of that, more than 100,000 interpreters and family members in Iraq alone are still waiting for their chance to escape. Steve has ambivalent feelings about the Iraq War. He says he harbored misgivings about it from the beginning in 2003 and almost resigned from the Army over it. He spoke last year with our own Army veteran, Nick Rimes.
When we made the decision to invade Iraq, my heart basically just dropped in my stomach. I felt really uncomfortable with it to the point where I was considering resigning my commission. I did not think it was the right decision. It seemed more politically based than strategically. Did not seem like the right thing to me. And I had no idea what was going to happen, but I seriously considered resigning my commission over the course of probably a couple of weeks. I just felt it was really a wrong decision to invade Iraq. And at the end of the day, it just came back to, I looked at the men and women who were there with us, many of them, like you, who joined because of 9/11, which is just such a testament to your generation that, you know, the men and women who join today know they're going to combat for the most part.
Right.
That wasn't the case with my generation when we were, we were hoping we might get a chance at some action, but we thought it would be like Grenada or
right.
Just Cause or something. Nothing like the grinding, you know, 18
Forever
years
war.
In
yeah.
Afghanistan. And I just looked at them and I knew they didn't have a choice, regardless of whether or not they agreed. And who was I, with the Army having invested so much training and education, where I could just say, I'll walk away from those young men and women. And so that was what kept me in at that time.
Steve first deployed to Iraq in 2004 as the operations officer for the Dagger Brigade, a combat team based in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. He returned to Iraq in 2007, this time as deputy commander of the Dagger Brigade in Baghdad. He was second in command in charge of 4,000 soldiers. It was this second deployment that opened Steve's eyes to just how indispensable interpreters were to the American war effort. He also learned, tragically, how dangerous their work was when one of his interpreters, nicknamed Jack, was assassinated.
So our interpreters, number one, they were all really skilled at faking whether they were Sunni or Shia, because you never knew what type of checkpoint you were going to run into. And Baghdad was really a mess. It was very complex. One neighborhood to the next, somebody else was in charge. It could be Al-Qaeda, it could be Sunni insurgents, it could be Jaish al-Mahdi. And they all use different attack techniques. And they also use different means of threatening and intimidating people who worked alongside Americans. And so Jack got a call from Balad, which was where he was from, which is probably about 40 miles north of Baghdad. And his wife had given birth to stillborn twins. And he said, I'm going to go home. And so, and we begged him, because the last time he had gone home, Sunni insurgents approached him and made him swear on the Quran that he was not working with Americans in the green zone, which technically he wasn't, because we weren't in a green zone. But his cover story was he was attending the Iraqi Police Academy, and that's why he spent so much time away. And that could also explain the increase in income that he had and was sending home to his family. So he went home to be with his wife and his family, and his dad called us on Jack's cell phone to let us know he was bleeding out in the street, having been assassinated by Sunni insurgents. Well, 2 weeks after that, Nadal, a beloved store owner, had gone into Shula, which is a Shia neighborhood in Baghdad. And Nadal ran a store on Fab Justice, which was our base. It was an Iraqi base, and we had a small American compound inside the Iraqi base. And Nadal got gunned down by a Shia militia at a checkpoint for working alongside Americans. And before that had occurred, George Packer came from the New Yorker at the time. He's with the Atlantic now. And he embedded, and we thought, you know, I was excited because I had read his book, Assassin's Gate, which was an indictment against the whole Iraq conflict, essentially. Right. And so I said, please, you know, send George to me. I'd love to just meet the guy and let him see whatever he wants to see. We had a lot of reporters embedding with us. And he got a call and got called away. His wife had gone into labor, and so he had to curtail the embed, and he flew home to New York. And so anyway, I was disappointed. I was like, well, nothing's going to come of that. He was only here for a few hours. So about 2 weeks after Nadal was killed, George sent me the link to a 15,000-word article that he wrote with a one-word title. And that one word was betrayed. And it was basically a scathing indictment of the lack of U.S. policy to insulate those who worked most closely with us, our interpreters and others. And it was so raw for me at the time that I couldn't even read it without breaking down. It was just, it really awakened in me the understanding that if we don't do something, you know, these guys aren't going to make it. And I couldn't look myself in the mirror and just walk away. You know, that's what gets imbued in us, that right. military ethos of leave nobody behind. And they were very much members of the team on patrol with us every day.
Steve believes we have a moral obligation to our Iraqi and Afghan counterparts who've worked alongside U.S. forces. They put their lives on the line to help the American cause, he says, and we can't just turn our backs on them. But it's not just a question of morality. It's also a matter of national security. If we don't protect our friends now, why would anyone step up to help us in future conflicts? It's a lesson that has guided our immigration policies in the past. When Mao Zedong took over China in 1949, we welcomed thousands of anti-communist Chinese into the United States. More than 40,000 anti-communist Hungarians came to the U.S. after the failed revolt against Soviet occupation in 1956. And when Saigon fell in 1975, more than 130,000 South Vietnamese allies escaped to our shores. Steve argues that we must continue this tradition of providing a safe haven for our comrades in arms. But so far, we haven't done it.
I mean, take the Vietnam conflict. I wrote a counterterrorism thesis on this issue of soft networks. I was so frustrated by the lack of policy when I got back from Iraq on my third tour that I came to D.C. And spent a year at National Defense University and College of International Security Affairs just thinking about this issue and trying to figure it out. And one of the fascinating things I'll never forget, Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, who had been ambassador to Turkey and then Iraq, came and he kind of kicked off this forum that we did for all the students and faculty. And he was in Vietnam as an infantry officer. And he described how the U.S. policy was, you will bring nobody out. And you had both people in the military, but also in the State Department that were violating that policy because of their moral compass at the risk of their own careers and still pulling their closest Vietnamese counterparts out and figuring out a way. And really, if you look at the policy of our country, we ended up taking, you know, almost about 250,000 Vietnamese in after between 1975 and 1980, I think, were the stats that I looked at. And it was just, you know, they ended up going, I think, getting vetted in Guam. And then, you know, some of them were the boat people who came over, but they escaped. And that's a much better track record, I think, in my mind than what we've done so far with both Afghanistan and Iraq. But the other thing I'd like to come back to is, you know, you mentioned the national security implications, and they are significant. They are beyond the moral implications, which should be enough. You mentioned, how are people going to trust us in future conflicts? Well, I'd walk that one back. How are people trusting us right now?
Right.
We've got men and women in harm's way right now who rely on these interpreters to help them not just make sense of the language, but their cultural eyes, ears, and mouthpieces. And they save lives many times because they know what's going on. They've got their fingers on the pulse. How are people going to trust us if they see these guys getting hunted down by the Taliban or ISIS because they supported, you know, the Americans? It impacts our narratives that, you know, we promote throughout the Middle East. It impacts our veterans, you know, you and me, who know these guys who have been hunted down and killed. A lot of veterans I talk to, they feel impotent in their ability to live up to that ethos of leave no one behind when they're leaving their most trusted Iraqi or Afghan counterpart behind. And they feel embarrassed by our country's lack of will to actually do something about it. And so my question, you know, when I talk to legislators or policymakers on this is that how we want our young men and women to leave their time in service feeling that way about right. our country? We can do better than that. And there are ways to do it, but we just need to get the political will to do so.
When interpreters come to the United States, they often continue serving. It's not uncommon for Iraqi or Afghan nationals in the U.S. to advise the CIA or military intelligence to help interpret what's happening on the ground in the Middle East, or help shape counterinsurgency messaging on social media to combat those ISIS videos, for example. Quite a few interpreters even join the American military when they get to the U.S. They find a home in the Army or the Marines. And some have even gone back to Iraq in American uniforms.
You know, I remember one of my favorite interpreters, his nickname is Ronnie. He's one of the main characters in the book I'm writing about the whole Underground Railroad. he described the first patrol that he went on. And Ronnie was on patrol every day with us when I was in Baghdad. But he showed up in his college clothes that he wore to university. So he was wearing white pants, you know, and like probably some flowery looking shirt or something. And after he went out on patrol, the other interpreters were like, are you freaking nuts? And they didn't even issue interpreters body armor or helmets at that time, you know. And so they're out there running around Baghdad. And then he found out that the reason he got the job was because the interpreter before him had been killed by Shia militia. And, you know, all that, he knew none of this. He just went in believing in the American cause and wanted to work on his English better.
Yeah, make a little money, take care of his family.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a guy who we gave a weapon to when we got on patrol, because I believed everybody needed to be able to be in a fight if the going got rough. And at the end of the day, after when we finally got him out of Baghdad, I want to say in, it must have been 2008. So he got approved for the visa in 2007, but ended up staying because he said, I don't want to go to the United States and be dependent on anybody. So I'm going to stay here and save up enough money so I'll be independent when I get there. Well, he ended up having some setbacks. His room caught on fire, $10,000 in cash burned up, along with his SIV paperwork. So he had to recreate everything and go through the process again. But we finally got him to the States, and his American mom, his sponsor, met him at the airport, and she took a look at him and said, he kind of looks like my son. And her only son was deployed to combat at the time. And she said, you know, I took one look at him and I knew he was going to be like a second son to me. And of course, he did what all sons do to their moms. He broke her heart and enlisted and deployed back to combat. And he stayed in that fight too. He ended up serving out his enlistment and then going to work for a defense contractor. And he was very much involved in sort of counter ISIS messaging on social media and pushing back against ISIS propaganda.
Though interpreters are not officially members of the military, they do fight. Officially, they're non-combatants, but in practice, they usually pick up weapons when the bullets start flying. However, when they're captured, they don't enjoy the privileges and immunities of prisoners of war under international law. So should we seek to change the law, or should we stop arming interpreters?
So that's a question that usually we only care about, we being Americans.
Right.
Because most of our adversaries don't care about that. They see a guy with a weapon, they're going to shoot him. But they also, they see a guy without a weapon, they're going to shoot him because he's with the Americans.
Right.
And so because it was so complex, I just was unwilling. And it wasn't like a flat out rule. And I had a provisional task force. We were in Qadamiya at FOB Justice, which is an Iraqi base. So everybody always had a weapon. And they always had ammunition. But with the interpreters going out every day on patrol with us, and you didn't know where you were going to get hit by, you know, Al-Qaeda, by Sunni insurgents, by Shia militia. And these guys were taking extreme risk. I wanted them to be able to protect themselves. With or without a weapon, they're in a legal gray zone, right? They're accompanying armed combatants. Technically, they're not a combatant. So they don't have the same protections as somebody who could potentially become a POW. You never know when we might get back into a more conventional type of conflict, right? Now everything's sort of gray zone, hybrid warfare type of stuff. I would expect that to continue, quite frankly. But if we were to get into, you know, a conventional war with Iran or, you know, Russia or somebody like that, then it ends up probably being an important point and something we should have thought about in advance before things go bad.
Our guest today was Colonel Steve Miska, who spent 25 years in the Army, including a term at the White House as Director for Iraq on the National Security Council. He's taught at West Point and Marine Corps University, and he's currently writing a book about his Underground Railroad that funnels interpreters from Baghdad into the U.S. Don't go away, because coming up, we have bonus material from our conversation with Steve, where he talks about his current organization, First Amendment Voice, and the role of veterans in helping to return us to a nation of civil discourse. But before we get to that bonus segment, I want to thank you for listening to Truth About War from the Veterans Breakfast Club. I'm Todd DePastino, and if you've liked what you've heard, you could rank us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You could also check out our show page at truthaboutwarpodcast.com. There you'll find show notes, links, and reading material, and viewing recommendations. I hope you also check out the Veterans Breakfast Club, which produces this podcast and harnesses the power of storytelling at live storytelling programs all open to the public, where veterans of all eras, all ages, and branches of service come to share their stories. We've been holding these storytelling programs since 2008, and over that time, thousands of veterans have shared their stories at over 500 live events. Veterans like Leona Woods, who joined the Army in 1976 when women were still segregated in the Women's Army Corps.
I originally wanted to go in the Army when I was 19. I saw the commercial, Uncle Sam wants you. And I told my mother, I said, you can't stop me now.
So what was your job when you were in the Women's Army Corps?
I was a fuel electrical system repairer with small components that we repaired, and I did it badly. And then they sent me to a primary leadership course for a month. And as soon as I got back, they immediately made me acting sergeant because they didn't have enough sergeants. And they gave me 8 of the worst guys in the company as squad leader. So I stayed in trouble because they stayed in trouble. And I finally got my sergeant stripes. And then I told them, now I'm a real sergeant right now, so you got to fucking do what I got to do.
You can listen to all of Leona's story and those of many other veterans from World War II to Iraq and Afghanistan on our Veterans Breakfast Club website, vbcpgh.org. You could also find our event schedule there. I hope you'll join us. Feel free also to write us at todd@veteransbreakfastclub.com or send us a Facebook message or tweet at VBCPGH. I'm Todd DePastino, and thanks again for listening to Truth About War. Now for our bonus segment. Nick asked Steve to talk about his new mission to promote free speech through his nonprofit First Amendment Voice.
So basically, First Amendment Voice is a movement to invigorate an understanding of the First Amendment freedoms and inspire people to really lend their voice to the public conversations that are relevant in their community. There's a general lack of civic education in our public education system now. When I went to high school, it was mandatory you had to take civics.
Right.
And older generations than me, we all were educated that way, and that's not so.
You're not that much older than I am, and I didn't have to take a civics course.
Yeah, and so that is a challenge. But also, because of the polarized state of our society right now, there's a lot of fear out there. People are afraid to offer their opinion, and people are very much able to curate the information that they get so that it doesn't upset them or isn't in disagreement with whatever their beliefs happen to be. And that's not a healthy thing for a democracy. And so what we're attempting to do is inspire people to understand why it's so important that they lend their voice in their communities, whether it's at the local level, you know, state level, national level, whatever position they're playing at, but that they can't withdraw either because of fear or because of apathy, where they feel like, well, my voice doesn't even matter anyway. We see those as two really dangerous trends in our country right now. And so what we're trying to do is educate people. And the First Amendment's very complex space. It's freedom of religion, it's freedom of speech, it's freedom of the press, it's freedom to assemble and to petition the government for grievance. Some of those freedoms sometimes can be in conflict with each other.
Sure.
The reason I'm called to this organization is because, and probably much like you, as a veteran, a lot of veterans now are taking off our uniform and we're looking for ways to continue to serve. And we see the current dysfunction in our political system and the divisive rhetoric and the ugliness that's out there in the public square. And we feel like we can maybe help bridge our communities and bring them closer together where we can respect each other's differences while seeking some sort of common ground.
Right. Because this is not a Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative issue. This is a serious issue on both sides.
Exactly.
And I'm going to use the most extreme examples here, but you know, there's some college students who want to be isolated and not hear any opinions that disagree with theirs. If it doesn't align with their values, they want to shut it down, which is not the right answer. And then conversely, you know, on the far right side, there are people that say recklessly dangerous things that think they should be able to do so without any repercussions, even though the First Amendment protects them from the government intervening. It doesn't protect them from their employer firing them.
Exactly.
And so, you know, every time someone says something racist and gets fired, it's like, oh, they're impeding on my First Amendment rights. Like, that's not how it works, guys.
Exactly.
Extremes on both sides of this are getting it wrong.
It's just like an insurgency, right, Nick?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the extremists continue to foment the violence. In this case, luckily, there's not too much violence in our country, but it's just really not civil dialogue, which is where we really need to be in order to solve the pressing real problems that we have in the country, whether it's immigration, whether it's healthcare, whatever your pet rock is out there. It makes your argument stronger to be willing to listen to people who disagree and to seek to understand why do they think that way. You can't get to that point if you say, well, the Democrats just want to open the borders and why do they hate our country? And then the Democrats are screaming at the Republicans for, you know, torturing babies and all this other stuff. You need to remove that and be able to
take
have
the emotion
real
out
conversation.
Of it.
Exactly. Right. Well, you know, Arthur Brooks, president of American Enterprise Institute, he just left, I think, to go teach at Harvard, but he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times back in March, I want to say. And it was one of the most helpful ways for me to think about it when I engage with audiences on this topic. He basically likened our current state of civil discourse to drug addiction and the way people are consuming information, right? He titled the op-ed, Our Culture of Contempt. And contempt is just so dangerous to healthy dialogue because when you actually hate those with whom you disagree, it just prevents any sort of conversation from taking place. You know, 1 in 6 Americans no longer talk to a member of their own family because of the current, you know, state of rhetoric. And so
it's a
anyway,
dangerous place to be in.
The drug addiction, right, is we know that this contemptuous behavior is not healthy for the public discourse, but it's also not healthy for us personally. It triggers the same types of hormones that drugs do in our body. But even though we don't like it, we still crave it more, right? It's feeding this adrenaline cortisol high that we're getting because it's confirming our own preconceived biases. And we're not able to find the space where we can sit down and try to understand why is that guy saying that? Like, and we need to find a way to get back there. And Brooks argues, he leaves the end of it optimistic. He basically says that the way to get back to some degree of normalcy is to stop listening to the profiteers who are making money off of this contemptuous behavior. The politicians who are intentionally divisive and the media personalities who are intentionally divisive. And it is on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
It is not just one party or the other or, you know, liberals on one side and conservatives on the other. There are lots of people in the media landscape who are profiting from this, and we need to carve out more space in the middle. And that's why I think independents are growing across the country and just abandoning political parties. I mean, I had an organization, I won't say what party it was from, but it was a women's group in Orange County. They reached out to me because they wanted me to come speak about First Amendment Voice. And I had a half-hour conversation on the phone. She was very excited. And then at the end, she said, is your wife coming with you? And I said, well, my wife's an elementary school teacher. She's got to work. She's not going to be there. And she said, oh, well, she's a member of our party, right? And I said, no, actually, my wife and I are not members of any political party. And then she paused and she said, oh, well, I'm sorry. We can't have you come speak to our organization. And I said, are you serious? And she said, I don't make the rules. And I said, but I served our country for 25 years. You know, I spent 40 months in combat. You don't think I might have something to contribute to your organization? I swore an oath to the Constitution of the United States. And she said, I'm sorry, I don't make the rules. And I just shook my head and said, wow.
Nick asked Steve what responsibility veterans have in helping the nation have civil conversations around tough issues.
Veterans have a special role to play in helping the country navigate the current territory we're in. And that's why for our symposium coming up in September, we are very much, the theme is polarization, but we're teeing up examples of people whose service transcends partisanship and whose organizations afford people the opportunity to contribute and to serve in a nonpartisan way. Because who's going to disagree with helping, you know, war widows and survivors of the fallen?
So final question, if folks want to get involved, where can they go?
Well, they can go to our website, which is firstamendmentvoice.org. So First Amendment Voice, all one word, .org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. You can find us there. You can sign up for a free monthly newsletter. But we're starting to try to convert that into podcast, you know, material. And we spotlight a good news story each month. And then, you know, as you know, with a podcast, you have a little bit more time to flesh that out.
Sure.
Rather than a 300-word article.
Right.
Because a lot of people prefer to listen to the stories rather than read them online. It's just another way to another channel to try to get that information out there. But people can find us in any of those platforms.
Thank you, Steve Miska, for sharing your story with us today. And thank you, the listeners, again for tuning in to Truth About War. For the Veterans Breakfast Club, I'm Todd DePastino.